I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome to Sick Boy, a podcast where we talk about what it's like to be sick. This week's guest is Kat. They had serotonin syndrome. Let's talk about it. All right. Well, this will be really fun. We are sitting down with Kat Orr all the way from Western Australia. And it's really late there right now. Kat, it's 1 o'clock your time, and you said you had a shift at 7.
I do.
God,
suddenly face painting.
Oh, yeah. Right. Tell us about what it is you do. You work with children, right?
I do. Yes. I do have a teaching degree. But at the moment, I'm essentially running a childcare center for school-aged kids. So it's like before and after school care. And so that's kids that are about 3.5 all the way to 12.
Oh, wow. You got your hands full.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I really love spending time with children. It's like it just, my heart fucking swells. It makes me feel really good. It, like, hearing children laugh is like one of my favorite things in the world.
Plus, because you act like one, you fit in.
I mean, I am a child. I'm pretty sure that when I'm hanging out with kids, I get this little boost of serotonin. You know what I'm talking about? Like that little serotonin boost when you're hanging out with some children. It makes you feel good, makes you feel happy.
That, totally. Like, just that right
amount.
And there's like
not too much.
Really? Because I feel like there's no amount that's too much. Like,
well, Brian, actually, let me step in there and correct you. There is such thing as too much serotonin. And we're probably going to hear a little bit about that because, Kat, we're going to be talking about long-term serotonin syndrome, to which I did not know there was long-term serotonin syndrome. And also,
I've never heard of serotonin syndrome.
These guys don't know what serotonin syndrome is.
I by the name, I would assume that you don't get enough serotonin.
That's what I thought. That was my initial reaction.
I think it's a little bit different. Kat, why don't you introduce yourself and let the guys know, what is serotonin syndrome?
All right. Hi, I'm Kat. As you know, I'm Australian. I am 25, and in, I think it was 2017 to 2018, I developed a pretty bad case of long-term serotonin syndrome. So long-term serotonin syndrome isn't as well known, and it's only really come about, I think, maybe in the past 2 or so years from what I've been able to find out. And it's, serotonin syndrome is an interesting thing because it's when you look it up, you either find studies and articles that are really clinical and make no sense to most people, or studies that are really, really simplified. And then you have to kind of put the puzzle pieces together. And then to have your own experience that you have to like tie in makes it a bit more difficult. But it's essentially, well, everybody has serotonin and you need that to be able to function. That's part of what helps you to function in day-to-day life, not just like mood-wise, but also just like brain function. And obviously some people have less and, you know, that'll be for a variety of reasons, such as like depression and that kind of thing. And you end up usually, hopefully, taking antidepressants for that kind of thing. But if it's not managed well or managed correctly, you can develop serotonin syndrome, particularly if you end up taking two drugs that interact with each other. And so they'll be, both drugs will run through serotonin pathways, or they're considered to be serotonergic drugs. And the interaction between those two is what causes such a like spike in serotonin. And so short term, it's seen in cases that'll last like 2 to 3 days. And I actually have one of my best friends around the same time it was happening to me, it happened to her. And I was so confused because I was experiencing something entirely different. And she was like, oh, you know, I just started like a new medication and it interacted and I developed some serotonin syndrome, so I had to stop taking it. Mm. And I was like, the fuck? Because that wasn't my experience at all, but that was hers. Mm-hmm. And that's the most normal. So then you stop taking the medication that's interacting and then it sort of dies down after a couple of days. Mm. Whereas for me, I was on 5 drugs that I was taking daily. Whoa. That all interacted. And that was for like a solid 8 to 10 months.
Whoa. Okay, so wait. So what you're saying is that there's drugs can like interact with your different receptors or like go into your body through different receptors. So like if we were to imagine drugs as like different types of drugs, as like bus loads of medication, bus loads of people going to different water parks. And at each water park, there was a lazy river. And
I'm actually
and
getting
so
angry.
You took these buses and accidentally or unknowingly, these buses went to the serotonin receptor water park. And then all of a sudden, there was just way too many people on the lazy river. And like usually, you could just kick those people out. Like, say one busload of people has to go out.
Guys, when we spend 7 days on the road together, we just need to take like a 5-day break.
I know, I'm feeling silly.
Wait.
This is a great analogy, Brian.
No, I'm asking
Kat
if this is correct, if I'm thinking about it. So usually you can just pack up a busload of those people and send them out, and that's fine. But you actually have 5 busloads of people there, and all of them are trying to go on the lazy river, and then you can't get them out of there.
Yeah, kind of. So it's like it's more like you have too many people trying to ride a ride.
Yeah.
All at once. Yeah. So they all want to go on the roller coaster.
Or lazy
but there are only so many seats. And so you're just packing like 3 into a 2-person seat.
And that's dangerous on a roller coaster.
Exactly.
So what's the difference between what
I understood when I actually only knew I came to know what serotonin syndrome was a couple of years ago. And the way that I came to understand what it was I was, let's say this will be a hypothetical story because none of this is actually true. Hypothetically, I took MDMA with some friends, and the following day with said friends, hypothetically, we all, one of them said, hey, if you're feeling down today, if you're feeling like that MDMA that you didn't take yesterday is making you feel down, take some of this 5-HTP. And 5-HTP is like a serotonin reuptake drug that like kind of refills your serotonin after having depleted all your serotonin from the MDMA. But one of the things they said was, by the way, if you take this, great, but in the future, do not ever take this at the same time that you take the MDMA. Because if you do, you're going to be overloaded with serotonin. And that's and which can lead to serotonin syndrome. And then the one thing that I remember hypothetically, if this conversation actually happened, was you can die from that. So serotonin syndrome, like if you get over flooded with serotonin, it can be a disaster. Like it can really fuck you up. But the thing that I'm so curious about is how the fuck can you get serotonin syndrome, but yet have it last for so long with something that can be so vitally dangerous?
Yeah, so it was definitely, it was progressive for sure. And it felt like at the beginning, because I know exactly when it started, all the way to the end, it was just getting progressively worse. And so my hypothesis for this is that it was like I was relatively okay at the start. And then because I was taking so many things, and I mean, I do have depression, I have anxiety, I have things where I am needing additional serotonin. So I am using up some of that, but it's like you're adding a teaspoon of water to a cup and eventually it starts to overflow.
Mm.
We had a conversation with somebody on the podcast. I think the episode came out maybe a week ago or so with a woman named Gabby who had an IUD put in, and her IUD caused a bunch of hormonal changes, and she went into like a really quick and deep depression, and she was having suicidal thoughts, and she ended up writing a book, very beautiful episode. You should go and listen to it. But one of the things that kind of came out of the conversation was like the kind of the fascination with the lack of information that she received about getting the IUD, and someone saying, hey, this is a potential side effect. With serotonin syndrome, are the medications that you're taking, like, is it individual, like the same two medications that might give me, or in your case, five medications that might give me serotonin syndrome, will they maybe not give somebody else serotonin syndrome? Or are these medications known, and are you getting that information from the pharmacist or from the doctor or whoever's or somebody in like the healthcare in the healthcare world? Are they saying, hey, look out for XYZ because these medications might react and cause such a thing?
Unfortunately, because we have an amazing healthcare system, and I really don't want to dismiss that fact. And sure, I've seen it do wonders for people, and it's helped me a lot. But the unfortunate truth is that it was a mismanagement of medication. I shouldn't have been prescribed all of these at the same time. And I know for a fact that I would always ask, like, is there anything else I need to know, or what should I be careful of? I never asked specifically, like, does this interact with X, Y, and Z, or what are the side effects? But I kind of expected that to be told to me.
Totally.
And yeah, I go to every appointment with all of my medications, because realistically, I have a lot of like health conditions. I have a lot of medications I take on a day-to-day basis, some of which are not as common. So it's always important for me to take that with me. And they have that information, and they have documentation, publications, and databases that they should be able to go to identify whether or not they should be prescribing an additional medication and whether or not it's going to interact. And they just weren't doing that.
Mm-hmm. Right. So it's just a slip up of the, it's just a crack. It's like a slip, this just slips through the crack, and
like a crack in the lazy river.
There's a crack in the lazy river. The yeah, river starts to flow down, and the information just does not get to you. Although it should have, it is known that these particular medications might cause something like this in somebody, but that information just never made it to you.
Exactly. And even things like going to a variety of different medical professionals throughout the time when I was dealing with serotonin syndrome, it wasn't picked up on. No one knew. And I'm very, very lucky that at that late stage it was picked up, because it could have gotten really bad really quick by then.
So Jared, when you said serotonin syndrome can kill you, like, do you know, or Kat, like what is the, I mean, I get the base function, too much serotonin, but what is the, you know, what causes the, how does that occur? How does it happen where it could be fatal?
I don't know exactly what it is, but it can lead to like unconsciousness and then lead to death. So you could kind of think of it as like an overdose, like a drug overdose of sorts, which I think, you know, there has been cases in the past where people have used their like antidepressants to take their own life.
Oh, okay.
And what's happening there, from what I gather, is that serotonin syndrome is basically the mechanism at which is,
okay,
you know, ending their life. But Kat, I don't know if you have more info on that.
Yeah. And I do. I also have like sort of symptoms which very much are written in a way where it kind of gives a progression, but essentially it's also referred to as serotonin toxicity, so it is over time poisoning you, and it's, you know, too much of anything in that situation, especially like a chemical in your body, is going to cause issues. And so it's things like, you get, for me it was actually like, so I don't sweat. I'm not a sweaty person. I just go embarrassingly red. And then people ask me if something's wrong. But all of a sudden I was sweating so much, and it was the worst, because at the time I was in my second year of university. I was student teaching. And it's like, how do you teach a bunch of four-year-olds while you're like dripping with sweat? And I was constantly embarrassed. But and that's how I know exactly when it started. Mm. But aside from that, it's things like confusion, disorientation, being really agitated, headaches. You can get like really high fluctuations in your blood pressure. You get shivering, tremors, muscle twitches, and like muscle spasms. Then you can end up with a fever, seizures, having fits and passing out. And then from there, it progresses to kidney failure, falling into a coma, and then death.
Oh my God.
So what were, like, when it came to a head, like, what were the worst symptoms that you were having when this was going on? And then also, like, how did you end up getting the diagnosis in the case that, like, long-term serotonin syndrome is, it seems so rare and not really much known about?
By far the worst was that I ended up having two seizures, and they were both very similar. And so I think they're focal onset aware seizures, which is that they're quite short. And then you don't pass out. You just have impaired awareness. And then you can have like repeated movements. Your eyes move back and forth sometimes, which is what I had. And I was alone both times as well, which was quite scary. Mm. And so that was like at the worst of it would have been that, but I kind of had most symptoms, and I really struggled with just being constantly disoriented, constantly confused. And my best friend at the time, who is still my best friend today, she was so protective of me during that time, because we were studying together, and it was like she would have to make sure someone was always with me because she just didn't know what was going to happen. Mm. And I didn't really, like, there's so much of it I don't remember. And like two of the crystal clear memories I have, actually there's three, but was a painting that I was doing, which I now have up in my bedroom. And I was painting it going, is this the last thing I'm ever going to create? Like, am I going to die before I can ever do anything else? And then the second is me trying to speak to my mom about it. But I was so confused, and I struggled so much to be able to articulate myself that she couldn't really understand what I was trying to tell her. But I was essentially trying to say, I genuinely think I'm dying and something is very wrong. And so my parents then, and I mean, I think it's important to also mention, like, my parents are amazing. They're incredible human beings, and they have helped me so much throughout everything that's happened. And they ended up leaving on a vacation, but because of course they wanted to get away from me. No, it wasn't because they didn't care. It was because no one really understood how serious it was. Mm-hmm. And so they had, because they're originally from South Africa, and they only moved to Australia after I was born. So they were going back for like a reunion for their university. They were gone for about 3 weeks. So it was my brother and I. And that's when it was actually the worst, is when it was just he and I. And that made it more difficult, but at least I had him, because he's a very logical person. He's an engineer. So we balance each other quite well. And I couldn't articulate myself. So I was in the bathroom the first time I had a seizure, and I didn't know what had happened. So I came out, and I just remember saying, like, I did something weird in the bathroom. And it's like, he's not going to jump to some sort of.
He's like, ew. I don't want to know.
Wait, you took a purple shit. Like, what's going on?
Exactly.
Like, when did, you kind of expressing, I think especially the like confusion of it all and the disorientation. And I'm assuming that you mean that in hindsight, the sweating was sort of the first, that's how you know when it started. I'm assuming that's in hindsight. Like when was it, and how did you, especially with all the disorientation, end up going, I need medical attention immediately?
that was probably when my parents got back and I tried to explain like what it had been like. And my brother backed me up by saying it was like interacting with a PC where the monitor was running and you moved the mouse and nothing responded.
Oh, that's so annoying.
I can't imagine how difficult it would have been to interact with me. I must have been a pain. And he was trying to like reorganize things at the time. And I just sat there or stood there. And it must have been like watching a sim that was being unattended to.
Right.
My parents eventually they were like, okay, so something is wrong. And they took me to my absolute godsend of a rheumatologist who has picked up on just about everything that he has ever needed to. And that man will forever be one of the best things that's ever happened to me.
Are you tired of hearing the same old wellness advice? It's time to dig deeper and listen to America Dissected from Crooked Media, the podcast that's cutting into the science, culture, and policy that shapes our health. From doctors fighting for their rights to the surprising truths about sunscreen, America Dissected dives deep into the state of health. Tune in every Tuesday for new episodes of America Dissected, available on all major podcast platforms.
Yeah, you said that you were sort of like no stranger to the healthcare system prior to this too, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's interesting because, Jer, I didn't tell you about this, I don't think, but about a month ago, I came home one night from doing something. I can't remember what we were doing.
And I was doing something really weird in your bathroom?
No. I was,
typical.
You just said it was really weird. But I had this like sort of like aura in my vision that came over, and I
that's not good.
And I couldn't see for like 30 minutes.
You told me this.
That sounds like I told you, I didn't tell you. Mini stroke.
So I was trying to read my phone and I couldn't read the text on it. And it was like really weird, but I'd come in from like bright light outside inside. And it felt sort of like that, like your eyes are readjusting thing, but my eyes just never readjusted. And it was like over 30 minutes like that.
Yeah.
And I called my mom and I called Maddie. And eventually they were like, you should go to the hospital.
Yeah.
And so I reluctantly, because I was like, I'd feel fine otherwise. I just can't see. And so I went to the hospital and
I feel fine. I'm just blind.
So, but this is actually my point to Kat. So when I went into the hospital, triage was 2.5 hours to see the triage nurse.
Oh, fuck.
And fucking so hell. I waited there long enough to see the triage nurse. They did an ECG on me. My heart was fine. My vision was fine after that. And then they asked if I was dehydrated or stressed. And I was like, probably both.
Yeah.
and they were like, okay, well, you know, it's an 11-hour wait here. So either you wait here to see a doctor or you go home. And they insisted that I stayed. But at that point, I was like, I'm going to go home. But my point in bringing this up is that as soon as I was like, something's weird about me. I ended up going straight to the hospital. And Kat, I'm curious if your brother said that you were like a computer that was not responding and you're just standing there in the living room and you said like, something weird happened in the bathroom. I'm curious, what was it that you thought was going on at that time? Do you have any recollection of how you felt in that moment and why did you wait so long to go to the hospital?
I felt really hopeless, honestly. And I felt like this was going to be a situation of like one of those really weird, fucked up medical mysteries where 40 years in the future they'd figure out what had happened. And I had like some strange poisoning or something because nothing was making sense. And the information on serotonin syndrome, which I did actually look at, did not fit my criteria because it was like, oh, it's really sudden. It's like 3 days maximum. And I was like, well, this is much longer than 3 days. Oop, smacking my microphone.
We couldn't see you. I thought maybe you had like a serotonin syndrome bout there. It sounded like you fell.
No, I was just doing something weird in the bathroom.
Did you tell?
That was the sound of the purple shit.
I just realized I have like staff members who are going to listen to this.
You're welcome, staff.
So, yeah, it was very hopeless. And I'd seen like my GP and I'd actually, I think, spoken to my psychiatrist as well. Mm-hmm. And they were like, we don't fucking know. And I was like, great. So that's entirely unhelpful. And I'm still stuck. And I think the weirdest part about it is people will ask that. And it's so hard to be like, this is normal for me. I have Ehlers-Danlos syndrome and accompanying that, I have something called dysautonomia, which is essentially just something that completely fucks your nervous system up. So it's your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. And it just completely obliterates the average normal nervous system. And I've dealt with these things for a long time. And part of that is that it's this constant ever-changing web of symptoms. There are issues that I had 5 years ago that I don't have now and things that I deal with now that I have never had before. And you get used to having symptoms just pop up and being like, oh, well, I guess that's a thing now that I have to deal with.
Yeah, I mean, like that, just to kind of hop in there, I totally get that. Even with CF, you know, like there will be things that happen to me and I go, well, this must be a CF thing. That's just like kind of new, you know, and like, but in reality, it's like, it probably isn't. It's probably tied to something else completely, like being, you know, dehydrated or stressed.
Hot
but
wings.
Like, but it's like, but I do. It's like when something new pops up, my go-to reaction is, oh, must be a CF thing.
It must be the thing that I'm actually very familiar with and totally used to.
And have been dealing with fucking every day for my entire life. Yeah. And like, especially with when you talk about like Ehlers-Danlos, like I know that Ehlers-Danlos is one of those illnesses. Like we were just hanging out with our friend Joanne in Vancouver who has Ehlers-Danlos. And like talking to her, it's one of those illnesses that just evolves and it's just constantly throwing shit at you and you're going, oh, okay, this is the new normal, I guess.
Also can probably make other symptoms from other things feel and look a different way too.
Yeah, right.
Did you feel like while you were going through this with the confusion and the disorientation that it was just really hard for you to intellectually like make decisions to go to seek help? Like I've been in a situation before where I was clearly needed medical attention, but just was like totally incapable of doing that for myself. It's like I needed a friend or a partner or somebody to like help me access, like physically and mentally access help, because I just wasn't able to do that. Was there any sense of that within this like confusion and disorientation? You just weren't able to help yourself?
Absolutely. And it kind of got to the point where I was like, I can't help myself. I don't know who is able to help me at this point, because everyone that I've seen so far, they don't know. It feels pointless. And one of my best friends that I mentioned before, Kaylee, she was saying, I will take you. If no one else is going to take you, I will take you who you need to see. And I was just like, I don't know who I need to see. I don't know what's wrong. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, I was like, well, I can't go through the motions or think through the steps to get there. And it took quite a long time. Like I spent like over a week writing all of my symptoms because it just took so long for me to even get that thought process completed.
Were you still like teaching at this time, doing the substitute teaching?
So that would be student teaching, which is a little bit different. So I wasn't qualified yet. And those, we call them pracs because they're praxis teaching. That was thankfully finished at the time.
Okay.
And so I was kind of in between two pracs at the time. So it was thankfully not going to impact that, because that would have been a nightmare. I would have had to pull out and then probably repeat a whole year of university.
Right. Yeah. I'm trying to imagine you doing your day-to-day things that need to get done while you're in the state. I'm imagining you can really do any of that. And so if you had to do practice teaching at the time or student teaching at the time, that would be a nightmare.
How did you go about getting the diagnosis in the end?
So I managed to get an appointment with my rheumatologist, and it was so funny. I walked in there, I gave him the list of symptoms. He looked at me, he did about two or three different tests, and he was like, yeah, it's serotonin syndrome. And I was like, are you fucking kidding me?
That was too easy.
Yeah. And that's why I appreciate him so much, is this is not the first time he's done this. This is probably like the fourth time. He's very, very good at just identifying that. And he largely works with kids, which I think is also incredible. But it was so easy. And there was no relief. It was just like, great, so now what? Am I still dying? Is that what is happening? Which kind of, yes. But it didn't make anything better. There wasn't an easy way out of this.
Is the way out? Like when he says it's serotonin syndrome, is it as simple as going, it's serotonin syndrome. We know that this happens because of a mix of medications. We have to just tackle the medication, like the amount of medication or the combination of medications that you're on, and this will start to dwindle. And like, you kind of have to, is it almost like sort of like withdrawal, I guess, in a sense, like you have to wait for that to go away over time as you change your medication.
Sort of, but it also, again, was not done nearly correctly. So an example of that is I'm actually still on most of those medications, just at a lower dose. And like, I'm kind of managing, and I know like the first signs now. But even then, when I was finally kind of going, okay, I know what I need to do, there was not nearly enough support. And again, trying to contact my psychiatrist, and he basically said, well, you probably need to stop taking some things. And it's like, yeah, no shit. Yeah. But I can't do that without knowing what is the best option here. Mm-hmm. And I ended up having to go cold turkey on my antidepressants, which were already way too high. And then that backfired completely because I became really unwell mentally within this span of maybe a day or two.
Because that's got its own, like, just, I mean, in a world where you were only on an antidepressant, going cold turkey on an antidepressant, that's not like, that's not advised, right? More or less.
Exactly. Yeah. And so that was what was told to me as first point of getting rid of things, I guess.
So it was like you were kind of getting was it like a process of elimination? They were going, just stop that and let's see what happens. And then I think so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What medications were they?
So I'm trying to remember. So amitriptyline.
Of course.
Cymbalta, which I can't remember the other names for.
You should see Brian's literally going, can't believe they prescribed me all those.
the reason why I ask the question is because I think that there's probably people who are listening who are like, fuck, am I on a collection of those medications and feeling that way? I'm just curious what they are.
Then I have really severe ADHD, and I develop a tolerance really quickly. So I take sort of alternating, I'll take Ritalin and Dex, and I know that dexamphetamine is also on that list. And then I was taking tramadol pretty much daily, and that's on there, and metoclopramide as well, which you're not supposed to take regularly because it's like a nausea drug. And I have really, really bad like motion sickness. I can't be in cars, buses, anything like that. And then it got really bad, so it was like consistently happening. And so I was taking it pretty much daily. And that's really bad because it increases a lot of things, including stroke risk. And I didn't know this until this year.
Mm-hmm.
And then there were a couple of other things that I was on and off as well that were just all on that list of things. Do not take these together.
I mean, like that happens like that, like not in, this is obviously in a way that is life threatening. But it is so fascinating. Just the function of being on and needing to be on so many medications. Like when my wife and I went through IVF and Kyla was on, holy fuck, she was on so much shit. And it was like, so, and on top of the prescription medications, it was also a ton of like vitamins and supplements. And it was always like, oh, you can't take this supplement with this medication, because if you do that, then the medication just won't work. Like it will just completely nullify that fact that you've taken it. It was like, you can't take this medication if you take an iron pill within like 2 hours of doing it. And so because of that, and I would imagine that you probably have, you, this is probably speaks to you, I would imagine, Kat, is like you end up having to basically take a medication at like every hour of the day.
Yeah, instead of having the pill boxes that are 7 days, you need one that looks more like a Google calendar.
Yeah,
with like your daily
like
hour
like
by
measured
hour.
Out by the hour, the half hour, because yeah. You can't take them all at the same time. You can't just take them all and shove them in your mouth, because then they all fuck each other up.
Yeah.
And instead you got to be like all throughout the day, you're like, oh, I got to take this one at 10:30. I got to take this one at 12:30 yeah. and all that shit. Like, is that true for you, Kat? Do you have medications that they're like, you just got to take these at different times because they'll all fuck with each other? And they
yeah,
obviously
absolutely.
All fuck with each other big time in your brain.
Yeah. Yeah. And because I also take a lot of like supplements because I'm deficient in just about everything, including sanity at this point. yeah. So it's just like a constant thing now where I'm like, yeah, this one. And it becomes such a routine as well. So I'm so used to it. And then people point it out and they're like, oh, you take like a lot. And I'm like, no, I don't. It's like, yes, I do. I just don't realize.
Yeah. If like you had a 24-hour cam on you and you just watched yourself walking through your life, you'd be like, God, I'm literally always putting something in my mouth at all times of the day. I'm just like constantly just popping. All the time.
Kat, I'd love to hear about life prior to serotonin syndrome, because you'd mentioned that you're dealing with Ehlers-Danlos and dysautonomia.
It's pronounced in so many different ways. I swear every time I pronounce it one way, I get told it's the other way. But it's either dysautonomia or dysautonomia. Depending on who you ask.
Right.
Or in which country you're in, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, coming from Western Australia, you can pretty much say whatever the fuck you want, and we're just going to go, all right. Cheerio.
That's cheers. Oh, there we go. He bounced. He went from Australia to Britain real quick.
Oh, yeah. You would not get caught dead saying cheerio here.
What, Ehlers-Danlos, something that we've spoken about a lot on the podcast over the years. How has that affected you? And like, and when did Ehlers-Danlos kind of become a part of your life?
It's really interesting, actually. So it became far more obvious when I hit puberty, because I had quite bad hip dysplasia. So one of my hips is essentially just sitting half out of the socket consistently.
Ouch.
Ooh.
And we had no clue. None of us knew about this. And it was only after I hit puberty and bone structure and hips started changing that all of a sudden it was really painful. I was struggling to walk. I was struggling to do just about anything. And I was using like a walking stick, which is really weird when you're 13 and in like your first year of high school. And funnily enough, we were actually going to see someone else. And I was in a friend group with a girl named Tess who had Ehlers-Danlos. And she was like, do not see this woman. She is awful and should not be practicing. Go see this guy. And this guy is my rheumatologist. Huh. And he sort of, again, just did a couple tests and was like, yeah, no, it's probably Ehlers-Danlos. And it probably wasn't picked up on because you would have been so bendy. But when you're a baby and they do all the tests, it's usually one of those things that doesn't get picked up on, or It does. And it's very like half-half. And depending on like your development, whether or not it becomes much more obvious. So when I was younger, I was quite overweight. And then I lost a lot of weight at around 16. And it was, it probably went from about 50 to 100. So it was like, even just that changed things completely.
Is like, is that a component of Ehlers-Danlos weight loss? Because I feel like I'm picturing everybody that I didn't really think about that until just now. And then I thought to myself, oh, I feel like everybody that I've ever met with Ehlers-Danlos is like, kind of has this very similar, like structure. They all are kind of like long and slender. Is that a thing with Ehlers-Danlos, or is that just happened to be?
I think it actually depends, because there are a couple of different types. I think there's actually like total of like 14 different types that you can have. And the most common are like traditional or hypermobile. But some of them do come with like really severe and then not so severe digestive issues. There's one, like you'll find there's quite a few people who have Ehlers-Danlos who also have feeding tubes like permanently, because they have such severe digestive issues. And I know like I've met people who where it's essentially like their whole digestive system is frozen. It just doesn't really work. And so they can't process food properly. Whereas for me, it was actually more of a choice. Like I chose to lose that weight. And I mean, it does definitely have digestive issue factors for me, but not nearly as severe as quite a lot of people.
I think one of the craziest things about Ehlers-Danlos that I've learned over the years is that you mentioned it, like it comes in so many different forms, and I feel like even with the first person that we spoke about Ehlers-Danlos with on the show, which was Joanne, we really kind of got really stuck in on the hypermobility part of it, and then later on, through further discussions with her, we realized like, oh, this isn't just hypermobility of your shoulder. Like it's also hypermobility of like the tissue that holds your heart in place.
Yeah.
And like how it just goes so much, it goes so much deeper than just surface level with like, oh, I tear my shoulder really easily. Like what sort of has it led to surgeries for you? You know, you mentioned some digestive issues. Like what are the sort of the main ways in which Ehlers-Danlos has affected you?
For me, the most obvious ones, if you're just looking at me, is it can affect your skin quite a lot as well. Because I mean, it's all related to essentially a defect in your collagen production. So I bruise extremely easily. I scar insanely easily. And when you've got a cat who is old enough that she doesn't retract her claws, that is a problem. And then it actually, and this fascinates me, it actually makes your skin more translucent. So you can see way more of my veins than most people.
Interesting.
Cool.
And then it can make your skin more stretchy as well, which I don't have nearly as much, but my brother does.
And he has Ehlers-Danlos as well.
Yes. So chances are both of my parents have the gene.
Right.
And we think my dad might have actually had it, but it's sort of rebounded now where he's not been treated for it. It hasn't been recognized. And now he's very stiff because over time his muscles have kind of just worked so hard that they've become immovable objects.
And is Ehlers-Danlos autoimmune?
Yes.
And is that what a rheumatologist autoimmune doctor?
Yep.
Just generally?
Yeah. Arthritis, Ehlers-Danlos, all that stuff.
Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that. I feel like because I always pair rheumatology or rheumatoid with rheumatoid arthritis. Right. Although I know that is an autoimmune condition. I just pair it with like arthritis as a singular thing instead of like seeing it as like an umbrella term.
Kat, I'm just coming back to the serotonin syndrome. When you got that diagnosis, what was the what was the plan? You know, I know that with people that have like severe serotonin syndrome, you know, the course of action is just like stop taking the meds that are fucking you up. So what did they tell you to do when when that doctor was like, this looks like serotonin syndrome to me?
It was basically just maybe stop some medication. Okay, bye. There was no real support at all. And I probably should have been hospitalized, especially knowing what I know now, the things that I dealt with, and even like the seizures. It took me years before I found out that's what they were. And there was so much of it that was just, I guess, shrouded in mystery almost, where I was just like, I don't know what any of this was. I don't know why it happened. I don't know what was happening. I don't actually know what was going on in that moment or what my body was doing that it shouldn't have been doing, what processes were happening. There was no explanation. So it took me quite a lot of time and a lot of research to put the pieces together. And I shouldn't have had to do that. And I think that's where I become really frustrated, is there was no support in place to stop this happening. And then there was no support after it happened.
I feel like kind of in like a more broader sense, like this is, it sort of just like, it kind of just speaks to, you know, you said at the very beginning, you know, like, you've got a great healthcare system and you're very grateful and there are lots of great people. And then it's like, but, and then I feel like that is like the, and I would say probably the same thing about Canada, great healthcare system. You know, there's lots of great people working in this, in the healthcare system. And then it's, but it's always followed by a but, and it's a, and they are massive systems. So obviously there's going to be failures and errors and things like that. But it really is kind of like the stories that we hear on the show of people that, you know, ultimately a lot of people get, find their way to the help that they need eventually, is most often the case, but not without like a ton of challenges and a ton of stress and work that if things worked in the way that we would hope they would, then they wouldn't have to go through that. And I think it just speaks to like the, how gigantic these systems are when you're dealing with millions of people that are, and people that work in the healthcare field, nurses, doctors, everybody else on layered in above and below, everybody that works in that in healthcare, of the simple matter that they deal with so many people. And so it becomes very easy for a person to say, you know, to say serotonin syndrome. And then like, just take some meds and then like, okay, like, you know, like let's shuffle out and like get the next person in. And, I don't know. It just like, it kind of just like breaks my heart a little bit that the thing, there is something like the healthcare systems that we have in countries like Australia and the UK and in Canada that are excellent, but at the same time need so much work. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of like a broader thought on like the challenges of the healthcare system as this like giant machine.
Yeah. Kat, what would you say is the biggest thing that your experience with serotonin syndrome has taken away from you?
I would say probably, I guess, the person I was before and the parts of myself that I was most proud of.
What would you say is the biggest thing that it's given you?
I guess perspective and a zest for life that I don't think I had beforehand.
Hmm. Well, Kat, I want to say, first of all, thank you for being up so goddamn late on a day where you have to work in just a matter of hours. We really appreciate you taking time to sit down and talk to us about your experiences with, you know, Ehlers-Danlos, your experiences with serotonin syndrome. It's been a really fascinating conversation. And on behalf of myself and the guys and all of our listeners, we thank you. Thanks a lot. It's been really fun.
And thank you. It's been really amazing.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.